Good morning. This is Brass Tacks Sunday, and we are talking about corruption and integrity mechanisms. Before we went to the brief break, I said we were going to return to Mr. Matthew Aubrey. Mr. Aubrey, you wanted to say something in response to this rich discussion that was developing.
Yeah, I just thought I wanted to underscore what Ms. Barrow-Giles has spoken about the concept of what these international studies would do. I mean, Transparency International is a phenomenal organization doing a lot of wonderful work. When it looks at Caribbean context, though, you'll see, and Barbados and Bahamas, we will flip periodically of who's the least corrupt. And the media takes that and does lots of interesting things with it. But it does speak to, it's a corruption perception index. And out of a score of 100, we would get 63. But that 63 is not only dependent upon some part of their perception, but they're also looking at academic information. And we're not great record keepers. So in 2019, rather, there was a more localized focus on corruption in the Caribbean by Transparency International to get a better understanding of what people really thought on the ground. Despite some of those least corrupt terms, you would have seen that 80% of people in the Bahamas felt that corruption was a big problem with government, 53% in Barbados at the time. And that still is a pretty significant number for us to consider that we think corruption is managed in our context. So I do think that as she said, corruption education is key. But I think we also have to look at the function of how government does work, because when you are a person who, you know, you've got to go to get something from the government, you're working minimum wage, you've got an hour, your boss is not going to let you sit for 3 hours on a line. It's a functional reality that you would find a way to manage that. And in the Bahamas, when they did that study, they found that actually of all the Caribbean, we were, the Bahamians were the most likely to pay a bribe because they considered that was just what you did. They weren't asked. It was just, oh, that's what you do. So we built it into our mechanism and our culture without thinking about the long-term effect. We're focused on the immediacy of I need a thing and the system isn't responsive to me and I just have to get through it. So it's not necessarily a reflection of, you know, some evil agenda, although obviously that does exist on your more significant or severe instances, but to tackle the impact of corruption, the percentage of dollars that ends up in a politician's pocket is probably small considered to the government waste that happens from the widespread use of corruption. So you think about the impact that if one person we recently had our road traffic system digitized. So before that it was all paper based and there was lots of opportunity for people to take money on the side to do the basics of their job they were already being paid for. And that became a very slow process. It became a very dysfunctional process. You had a lot of cars on the road that were not safe. You had things that were polluting. You had all kinds of things that were clearly what the whole regulation in place was there for. And subsequently, not only are you talking about the cost or the loss of effectiveness, but think about the space in that business in that government service. The person who is the least committed to doing their job as was charged by the government and dedicated to the people who are paying for that job is actually the one getting the most remuneration. So it bleeds a culture that, well, if he's getting it, why shouldn't I get it? And that then further slows up what needs to happen. And it reinforces those that have can get through, whether they have access or whether they have funds. And those that don't have to sit and wait. And that not only has an economic cost that we all pay for, but it has a social and a political cost in that it builds in concepts of mistrust, or even worse, just acceptance that's all that government can do. Mm-hmm. And that means all the taxes that we pay, and there's a limited amount of money that goes around in all of our countries, right? Even though we're considered high income, we know that that's just a very small segment of the population that is weighting the rest of us. That means the burden falls proportionally on those that have the least. They get the least amount of service and they pay the most proportionately for bad service. And that's the biggest, you know, that's one of the biggest impacts that we don't tend to think about when we participate in the day-to-day minor acts that you know, micro corruptions, as they might think about them.
Right. So it reinforces inequality, and by extension, it means that those who are potentially more vulnerable in our societies have less access to the services and so on that they require. Okay, thank you.
Christina, if you don't mind, if I may just intervene again. I'm sorry to do this, but there are a couple things that were raised. One, you asked a very specific question about whether or not to run it. And I suppose you're asking that question because he's the legal mind on the panel. And the question you asked was whether or not there's a legal definition of corruption. And he quite rightly pointed to, agreements, et cetera, like the UN Convention on the Elimination of Corruption, et cetera. So clearly what we can do is to look at international public law, because international public law lays the foundation for a lot of the understandings that we have. The other thing too is that certainly we can move beyond the UN and we can go more localized. So that, for instance, I find the African Union also has a very good definition, as does the OECD countries have a very good definition, and the OAS, as to what constitutes corruption. But I don't think for Barbados you need to go very far to find a definition of corruption. And therefore, what I want to do is to just make reference to the bill, which became law, actually. Well, it didn't become law. It was actually passed in 2012 under the former administration on the prevention of corruption. Yeah, it was never proclaimed, and that is the problem. So now, of course, this current administration is in the process of bringing forth another bill to deal with or to treat the issue of corruption. But essentially that, and I should say that this current bill does not, in its draft formation, does not have a definition of corruption. Right. But the former one, which was produced under the DLP administration, describes corruption or defines corruption as any act in which persons in public life seek to gain advantage for themselves and others, whether through such means as a gift, a loan, contract, valuable property, employment, the exercise of forbearance, from the exercise of duty, power or right, an offer, promise or undertaking, whether conditional or unconditional. That is the definition under that particular act for corruption. The other thing I wanted to just speak on was what was raised by Matthew in relation to persons who find themselves faced with very limited opportunity and limited time, and therefore they are quite willing to pay a small bribe. So you want to clear your goods at customs, why not pay a customs officer a small bribe? And I keep saying that, unfortunately, customs happen to be a institution that is an easy target, and is an easy target because customs officers do have control over the imposition of taxes that come in through the border, and therefore they are very easy to attack. But I am not attacking customs officers. I'm just saying, for instance, that you want your goods cleared. For instance, the private sector, they want their goods cleared in this November, December, because Christmas is coming up and they need to have their goods out there. Then what is wrong from their perspective than to pay a customs officer a few dollars, etc. Now, what people are arguing is that what this does in a sense is to speed up a very slow machinery that frustrates competition, frustrates development, etc. So in that way, corruption is functional. But as you just indicated, we have to look at what are the negative implications of such a behavior being entertained by customs or by any other agency, including price control, etc., immigration, etc., and being done on a wide scale. What is the end result for government, who sometimes loses revenue from the taxes which should have been imposed, depending on, of course, what arrangement we have with the agent. So one of the things I want to get in, I said that to set the basis for a discussion on what is it that is required. Because again, I heard what Matthew said in relation to the time wasted in trying to get a government service, and probably not private sector, because private sector, they organize themselves on the basis of, they try to organize themselves on the basis of efficiency, etc., because time means money for the private sector. Apparently the same thing does not hold for the public sector, I'm just saying. But certainly what it seemed to me that's among things that we need to contemplate is the extent to which we have to undertake some kinds of reform that will reduce the monopoly that is exercised by the agents who have responsibility for undertaking certain functions. Because one of the things we realize is that corruption will not take place in the absence, it would not take place in the absence of monopoly. It would not take place in the absence of discretion. And so that, among other things, what we have to do is to reduce the discretion, reduce the monopoly, which permits that level of corruption. And at the same time, what we ought to do is also increase the level of transparency, so that once we increase the level of transparency, while we reduce the monopoly and reduce the discretion that public officials have, for instance, over a service or good, it may very well reduce the tendency towards corruption. And I really, really do want to endorse what Matthew had to say about what takes place in the Bahamas, which by extension takes place all across the Caribbean, with respect, of course, to how citizens feel. If you talk to them, how they feel about corruption, notwithstanding the fact that we're seeing that people feel they have a right to do it. Some of them acknowledge that that is in fact corruption, but the vast majority of people do not quite recognize that what they're actually doing and what they have done for decades and what their grandparents have also done for decades is in fact corruption. But certainly when we look across the Caribbean, what we'll see is that if you do ask people about whether or not there is public sector corruption, they would tell you, because they know of their own personal experiences, they would tell you, in fact, yes, they have. There is, in fact, tremendous corruption. I just want to make one further point. A lot of those surveys which are being conducted and the people who are being interviewed are not necessarily the average citizen in the society. That a lot of those surveys are based on the perception of foreign businessmen and the way in which they relate to the individual Caribbean country. And sometimes, of course, they bring together some businessmen and they ask them questions. So again, we have to look at the methodology. I'm not knocking Transparency International. I think it is one of the most worthwhile international organizations that are out there. And we have learned a lot from the operations of Transparency International. But certainly we have to look at the methodology being used in order to determine the extent to which there is corruption. I am concerned that when I look at Transparency International report, for instance, that whereas they have said that Barbados, yes, is probably the least corrupt country in the Caribbean. I may be a little wrong and somebody may correct me here. But certainly one of the things I recognize is that almost every single Caribbean country, and that includes the Bahamas, actually fell in relation, not necessarily to the ranking status, but in relation to where they were. So that even if Barbados is the least corrupt country in the Caribbean, Barbados actually performed, I think, subject to correction, actually performed worse than it did last year and the year before. We have all declined. A lot of countries globally have also declined. And Christina, just one last thing, because I hope in the next 2 hours, in the next 1.5 hours, we can also
talk. We have a lot of time to talk, you know, Cynthia, but go ahead.
Yes, I know they have time, but there are so many. It seems that the so far when I listen to Matthew and Ronnie and Crystal and your interventions, it is so rich that I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. And I don't want us to run out of time without putting on the table one of the things to me which is very vexing. And again, it's because of the kind of work that I do. We're talking about public sector corruption. But one of the things, two things I would like us to get into, but I'm going to raise one right now, and probably the other one is linked, is the fact that we are not dealing with election-related corruption. And we certainly need to deal with that. And we're talking about abuses and politicians and graft, etc. But what about the conduct of election officials? I mean, Guyana is a classic case in point. And so we also know that I think it was last week or week before, the Caribbean Court of Justice, and Ronnie and I have been doing some work on the judicialization of elections in the Caribbean, but the Caribbean Court of Justice had to do another intervention in this case in relation to election corruption outside of merely the tweaking of the votes that we saw taking place in Guyana. What we see is that for some time, all election observers that have arrived in the Caribbean have spoken about the fact that on the laws, on either whether it be in ancillary election laws or it be the Representation of People Act, they speak of the issue of bribery and cheating. Yet still, where the Caribbean is concerned, we are seeing not only bribes occurring in the form of the same vote buying you spoke about a while ago, Christina, or patron clientelism, but we see it taking place in relation to cheating. So government have passed laws, but by their very definition, because of the behavior of the political parties which form the government, they have actually engaged in cheating, and therefore that is a form of corruption. And the Caribbean Court of Justice weighed in on that, and in fact indicated that some of the members of the present Dominica Parliament who were elected into office did in fact violate the very law that they have sworn to uphold now by engaging in cheating. So I'm just hoping that we, among other things, were able to put this on the table as well.
Okay.
I just want to add very quickly to what Cynthia was saying in terms of the definition, because the very definition was very similar to the one I read out, and that was from the law, because those definitions are from the convention. So what that 2012 act that the Democratic Labour Party passed but somehow was never proclaimed, it actually tried to bring the international law that we had agreed to into the local legal system. So it's interesting that later on the bill that the current government tried to pass did not do something similar, and we have that. So our question, the question is, why are we signing on? This is another bone of contention. Why are we signing on to international treaties against corruption and prevention of corruptions, but then we do not bring them into the localized system to give them effect? And I saw something, this is not necessarily related, but I want us to get this in, because I saw the Attorney General, I think it was yesterday or the day before, made a point that we can sign international treaties essentially, but do not have to bring them into local law, but you can still have the effect and the access of those treaties. And he referenced the Caribbean Court of Justice case. I want to say that is not correct, because if there's a clear reading of the Caribbean Court of Justice case of Boyce, what it is saying is that you can have procedural access to those treaties, but you do not necessarily have the substantive access to the rights in those treaties. Therefore, if you want international law to have bearing, when we sign it, we still have to make it statute. It still has to go to Parliament. It still has to be passed through our system. And this is essentially what you realize the Democratic Labour Party tried to do with the Prevention of Corruption Act 2012. But later, the other corruption, the New York Corruption Act, did not seem to do this and did not seem to strike that to make the same approach. So I just wanted to bring that point, because it seems as if the government's view and thinking, incorrectly, I would add, from what the Attorney General said yesterday, is that we can sign on the treaties, but don't worry, doesn't have to come into the legal legal framework, but you can still have access to them. That's not necessarily true.
So I want to follow on from something that you said, as well as Ms. Barajel's. So this is talking about the definitions. And you were very helpful to me last night, because I was having some difficulty finding some of the legislation myself. I'm not a lawyer, so sometimes this thing is a little confusing to me. But I was looking at this recent bill to form an anti-corruption and anti-terrorism agency in Barbados. And I was trying to see what the definition of corruption is in there. And what I found was, I'm reading directly from it on page 8, okay. Corruption means an offense under any enactment relating to corruption. I just found that
is less tautological.
That's not helpful in any way. So then I said to myself, okay, I'm not a lawyer, so I am a regular person now in this context, and I am trying to figure out, what is corruption? What kind of things can I report if I suspect that, you know, there's a corrupt activity? Am I right? Am I wrong? The only other thing that I believe that I can look at is the Prevention of Corruption Act, which exists from 1929. And in there, from what I understand, corruption is primarily the giving and acceptance of bribes. That seems to be the beginning and the end of it. And it is also a misdemeanor with a maximum penalty of $2,400. So I'm a little bit confused as to, you know, the current framework that is in place. Can you all shed a little light for me as to how it is people who feel that they have seen something that is corruption, how can they be guided as to what to do, if they're correct, where do I go? Give us some help here.
I don't think you're confused, Christina. I think you are correct. let's just get that, and let's make that very, very clear. And what essentially I think the government did, because the previous Corruption Act failed. We know the saga, we know the theater of its failure. So let's put that aside. And what you have in this anti-corruption, with the anti-corruption, anti-terrorism agency act, which I'm looking at the moment, I've pulled it up. You have a very broad, almost meaningless definition, because we have not passed the Prevention of Corruption Act. So I assume that this would have actually been tied specifically and to reference the act But because you've not done that, and you're trying to pass an act related to corruption about the agency, you have to create this almost broad, meaningless definition of corruption until you. So you're putting the cart before the horse.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, what needed to happen, as you're correctly pointing out, to pass a modern new Prevention of Corruption Act, which would contain the definitions of corruption so we can identify specific acts of corruption, and then you pass the Anti-Corruption and Anti-Terrorism Agency Act, which would be related to and connected to that particular law. So you have an Anti-Corruption and Anti-Terrorism Agency to fight corruption under the 1929 Act, essentially. And the view is, hopefully, that we'll get an updated Prevention of Corruption Act shortly. But if I were the government, I don't think I would have done it this way. I would have ensured that you had the modern act first, and then you deal with the agency, or at least you run them parallel. They should be run them parallel. So that's why you're seeing that discrepancy that you rightly identified.